Hello and welcome to the A Perspective with me, Andrew Skipper. I'm head of the Africa practice for international law firm Hogan Lovells and a member of the UK government's Africa Investors Group. I'm passionate about doing business in Africa and providing legal support for companies who are invested in the continent's future. Through these podcasts, I'll be exploring how business and government are working together in Africa, particularly as we navigate a way through and hopefully now out of the COVID-19 pandemic. My guest today is Lucy Quist, international business leader and author. Lucy has previously and variously headed the Ghanaian Football Association and been CEO of Airtel Ghana, and we recently saw her compare the UK-Africa Summit for Her Majesty's Government in the UK, a genuinely four-square individual. In between, she's published her new book, prophetically called The Bold New Normal, which came out in April 2019, and she's an electrical engineer by education. So welcome, Lucy, to this great day.
Thank you very much.
Lucy, we last met, believe it or not, in Buckingham Palace, I think, earlier on this year, in the warm glow of optimism following the UK-Africa Investment Summit, which you excellently compared. How things have changed. How's your lockdown been? And are you still optimistic?
Gosh, lockdown. I am still optimistic, so I'll start there. Absolutely optimistic. Yeah. I think that the human spirit is strong and we will get through this. I also try to remind myself and my children that the vast majority of human beings have not contracted this virus and are not ill at the moment. So we do need to focus on supporting and helping those who unfortunately have done so and find a more global solution, but we will make it through. But lockdown has been an experience, I must admit. I'm currently in Ghana, but prior to coming to Ghana, I had started working from home in the UK. So it had been a couple of weeks of trying to get used to the routine of getting up, doing the right thing, like exercise and so on, and before I get into work. But then on Saturday, the 21st of March, the president of Ghana announced that the next day the borders were going to be closed. And at that point, we as a family had a decision to make because half of my husband and my niece were here. The boys and I were in the UK. And it was, well, where do we want to be locked down? Because ideally, we want to be together as a family. And
of course,
we had been thinking of coming to Ghana and we had to fast forward that plan. So rather dramatically, Saturday night, a relaxing Saturday night turned into a frantic packing Saturday night to rush to Heathrow on Sunday morning, the 22nd, and make it to Ghana with the last BA flight. And I was just so thankful for all the people at the airport, the BA staff who are willing to keep, stay working just to get some of us across the globe. So that was an experience in gratitude. And then we arrived in Ghana and we had to be in mandatory quarantine, which wasn't a surprise for us because it had been part of the president's announcement. But I'll be honest, it's tough to be locked in a room for 2 weeks, even though you have internet and you can work and maybe you can call people. You don't actually see anyone, obviously fed and watered, but also subject to, testing to make sure you're okay before you're released into the general population is the only way I can describe it. But we made it through. But it is a tough experience, but a necessary one, because some positive cases turned up and those people were able, the government was able to isolate and help those people. And I gather the vast majority have now tested negative for the virus. But that was an interesting start, which has in some ways made this next phase we're in, where I'm at home, but we're trying to stay in and, movement is limited in Ghana, maybe a little bit easier because of the first 2 weeks. Not ideal, but we're making our way through it. Thank you for asking.
It's a pleasure, and I'm delighted that you came through it. But it seems to me that there may be maybe there are some lessons for others to learn from the way Ghana has approached the pandemic.
Yeah, I do think that the biggest lesson, which from I've experienced in Ghana, but I've kind of read about in many African countries, is that I think most African governments recognized right from the beginning that the continent does not have the luxury of widely accessible healthcare, not in face of a pandemic, right? So if you look at the ratios, whether it's doctors, hospital beds, nurses, any ratio will tell you that the services are inadequate across the continent, right? So I think what the government of Ghana did was, here's a problem. There are many solutions to this problem. We know there's a weakness in, and I'm speaking for them now, me just reading into what's gone on. How else can we address this, right? So wait for people to get sick, or you can say, how do I stop them from getting sick in the first place? And I think they've gone more for the approach of, how do we, you know, stop them from getting sick, or minimize the spread as much as possible. And I think that's a big lesson that not only can other countries learn from, but perhaps African governments can take forward into solving other problems on the continent post this pandemic.
Interesting. And I think that before we move on to your book, you live between the UK and Ghana. How do you see the way people are reacting, as it were, in the West to Africa in the context of this pandemic? Do you think it's an appropriate reaction, an accurate reaction?
I don't think it's generally accurate. And I don't think it is generally appropriate. And the reason why I use the word generally twice is that I have seen the odd article written that's more objective. I was reading one from a US publication yesterday that talked about, you know, what if we just accept that some of the countries have gotten things right? Why do we have to explain it away by miracles or, you know, and I'm not making this up, magic or whatever. The explanations are varied. So I think in general, there's this, globally, the perspective is if the world has a problem, then it's, you know, worse in Africa, whatever the problem, you name it, whether it's healthcare, whether it's rights, whatever it is, the assumption is the world has a problem, it's going to be worse in Africa. And so a lot of the coverage has focused on either pockets that have a high number of cases, and at the moment that is really in pockets, or explaining how, the numbers aren't visible because someone's not telling anybody, people, everything. So there's always an explanation, which is removing the capacity of the African or the African government to solve a problem and saying that this is happening, not because they did something, but because it was some kind of fluke. And so the coverage, I think, needs to be more investigative, to really do more analysis, to understand what is going right and how those lessons can be taken forward. And so the coverage, I think, needs a lot of work. A lot of work needs to be
done. And you talk in your book a lot, just to look forward a bit, you talk a lot about rebranding Africa. And this is something I've been on the continent a lot, and I've heard Dr. Arama from Afrexim, I've heard President Adesina, all talking about the need to rebrand Africa. Mm-hmm. And as I say, you talk a lot about it in your book. What do you actually, I mean, and I think the last question follows directly into that, really.
Yes.
And so what does this mean to you, and what do you think is actually needed now to rebrand Africa?
Yeah, again, we're almost stuck in a loop, right, where I say to people that, look, I've been around a few decades, and in my lifetime at least, the narrative of what Africa is and what African countries are has not changed. And if you go back even older than me, it's the same. So when I talk about rebranding, I'm not referring to sort of a marketing campaign where you're just trying to, you know, talk things up when they don't exist. What I'm talking about is that Africa's brand is so stuck in what doesn't work, right? So if you take a country like Ghana, for instance, even by international definitions, the last time I read, this figure might be a couple of years old, the percentage of Ghanaians who were defined as, you know, in survival mode, really poor, was 12.5%. That was that kind of figure, which I'm not saying is ideal. I'm not saying it doesn't require any more work. But the brand would, you know, internationally would probably say that all Ghanaians are just poor, right?
Yeah.
And I cite example after example of where the good things that are happening in African countries and the progress that they're making is not talked about and not recognized. And the whole country is branded on what doesn't work in the country, which leads to all sorts of things, right? So if we talk about investment, as we did at the UK Africa Investment Summit, there's a lot of talk about risk premiums and rates at which African countries can borrow. Well, part of the premium to lend to you is also about how you're perceived and how your risk levels are perceived. And if the outside investor keeps thinking that everything about you is challenged and they're not sure how you're going to make the money back, they will charge you more as a risk premium. So it goes hand in hand that we need to talk more about the great things that are actually happening on the continent so people have a more balanced view of what an African country is about.
Absolutely. And I think the point you make well that is it's not just window dressing. It's based on authentic, it's all brands have to be based on authenticity. And yes. I think that's what you're saying.
Yes.
I mean, going back, I mean you wrote your book, The Bold New Normal, middle of last year, April last year, I think. Everyone's now talking about having to get used to a new normal, as I think they did after 2008. Then COVID has happened since your book. Were you just prescient then, or has COVID changed your vision of what you mean by a bold new normal?
No, my view hasn't changed at all. So writing the book was really based on my experience of having worked on the continent since 2008, albeit in telecoms, but it was in different countries. So I did get exposure to different countries, you know, West, East, Central, and so on. And so the book is really about boldly recreating Africa, right? Because we've assumed a certain normal about it. So in a way, the current pandemic reinforces the message that this is actually an urgent call that we need to fix the continent.
Yeah.
I wish we didn't have a pandemic and we could just get on with it. But absolutely, the book, even I wonder, like, you know, how, you know, why was it called this? But again, it's based on that experience. And it's the experience that says we've assumed a certain normal for Africa for way too long. Mm-hmm. Why don't we boldly redefine what normal can be in Africa and create it?
Yes. And equally, the Africa Union, I'm sure you know, has recently called for a fresh paradigm. I think they're calling it post-COVID-19. Mm-hmm. Including revising relationships with the world outside Africa, and I think particularly China they refer to there. Does their vision align with your own roadmap for a new African paradigm where, as you put it, everyone prospers?
Yeah, so you know, I haven't read all the detail of what they're thinking of. I have been following rather closely through, especially through my contacts, the vision and implementation around the free trade agreement.
Yes.
So as an example, I would say, yes, that very much aligns with my vision, because I think to prosper, this word prosperity is where a human being can just make assumptions that, you know what, I have the opportunity to just be the best of myself. Like the environment is reasonable. It's up to me to make the most of it. It's not there for most Africans. And if Africans can trade more with each other, circulate more of their the money they make within the continent, be the first people to support their own products, goods, and services, then it makes it more appealing to other people around the world. But if Africans don't want African goods and services, I don't see why we should assume that someone else would. And how do you prosper if what you produce is not wanted by anyone else but yourself? So the whole a paradigm shift around bringing African countries together around not only trading and doing business with each other, but I hope that part of that will even call for things like centers of excellence, right? There has to be regions and countries in Africa who are good at one particular service, and that can be amplified. And, you know, not so long ago, many West African doctors at some point in their career would come to Ghana for training. And then I'm talking back many, many years. And it's something I discovered more recently that's what was used to happen. It was seen as a center of excellence for medical training. And they'd all come to the biggest hospital in Ghana and they'd top up whatever education they had and they'd go back to their countries. Now, it doesn't have to be the same form of center of excellence, but it's a good example of how it's possible. Because if we're starting from a base that might be smaller than other countries, rather than every country trying to fix everything on their own, if each can own a few things and do them really well, it becomes a service that can be provided to other countries.
Indeed. This isn't going to happen on its own, though, and you speak a lot about leadership in your book.
Yes.
With the, I guess you could call it a gerontocracy, which has defined African leadership over the years, seemingly continuing, who should be the drivers of change? I know you're passionate about the role of women in this and the young. How do you see leadership being redefined in the new paradigm?
I think the incentives of leaders, and in this case, perhaps we're talking more political leadership than everything needs to change. And that is why I place a lot of emphasis on young people, perhaps women as well, because I'm talking about the groups of people who have more power than they realize, because their choice of who leads actually matters. They can sway which way it goes. But until they decide that they will only support leaders who serve their interest, then you keep getting leaders who serve, who will want to serve their own personal interest. So it's really important that, look, most African countries are democracies. So it's really important that the population recognizes that the idea of having a new normal that's different from what their parents have lived through is possible, and they should demand it. And they should demand it by saying, you can only lead me if this vision of the future is part of your agenda. Good real life example, during this pandemic, a young man has designed, there have been a lot of designs, but I'm just talking about one in particular, a new contactless wash basin is the best way I can describe it, right? And he uses a barrel, but it's got sensors so that when you approach it, the sensor will squirt out the soap, and then the same sensor allows water to flow for 20 minutes and wash your hands and so on. It's solar powered, right? So right for the environment in Africa. And it's the water's, you know, collected in the barrel. It's all, you know, partitioned and really well made. Well, this device has existed for a while, but he had challenges. He had challenges in terms of getting it approved. He had challenges in terms of funding. And all of a sudden, all that changed. Literally, the standards board in Ghana took a look at it. It had been spoken about. The president spoke about it in one of his national addresses. And now he has approval, and people want to order it because, yes, we don't have running water in every corner of the country, but let's, you know, execute solutions that can provide the best next thing, especially now that we really need it. And that's an example, right? Because it required a waiver on his registration fee because he's a young entrepreneur. He does not have the money for that. It required a fast track. It required attention from leadership for him to get through from innovation to a product that he can actually sell.
It's an interesting connection with that, and because in your book, rather starkly, you say that poverty is the result of a system which is designed to produce poor people. Do you think what you've just said, with a bit more flexibility and a bit more openness to other people, that can change? And what do you mean by that first, and how do you see that can change? Because that's a rather stark statement.
Yeah, so the example certainly is relevant. The starkness of the statement is it's multi-layered. So it is a stark statement, but it's multi-layered. So one of the things I talk about in the book, an example I gave in the book, and this is a real life example. I was in a room talking to a class of university students, very respected, very high caliber students. And I posed a very simple question. I gave them an example of a brand of body cream that's not manufactured in Africa. And I gave them an example of locally produced cream from shea butter, which is very popular around the world now. And I asked them which they would pay more for. And they said the imported product. And I asked them, well, which do you think is better for you? And they said the local product. And I said, well, how is it that you pay more for something that's imported, even though you know this other product is better for you, right? And the bottom line is they explained to me that, oh, you know, the imported product, probably some, you know, scientists have looked into it. And they gave me a, you know, rather weak explanation. But fundamentally, what I took away from them was that we have a perception that if it's imported, it's better for us. Well, if every pound, every dollar, every CD you make is focused on buying things that you don't produce, then you're always constantly pushing money out of your system to structurally deprive that local producer of a market. That creates poverty. The things that we need to address to take people out of poverty start from us accepting that people are worthy of not being poor, that structurally we can create a system that doesn't make them poor.
Just to, as a final question, what would be your message, I think, to Africa and African businesses at this time in the context of what positive actions can be taken out of COVID to deliver the new African brand?
One of the biggest lessons from a private sector point of view that's come out of COVID is that businesses in Africa are actually a lot more flexible than perhaps even they themselves appreciated and recognized. And I always like to use simple examples because it's language that we can all understand. I was completely positively surprised at the speed with which Ghanaian manufacturers switched into producing hand sanitizer. There's been no price inflation. It's abundant. It's everywhere. They switched into producing, those who used to make clothes switched into producing masks, switched into producing PPE, the innovations in the marketplace, so on and so forth. It's just been, in spite of the fact that I've written this book, if anybody told me that there's that level of nimbleness to switch so quickly, we're talking days and not years, yeah, I would have said, I'm very optimistic, Andrew, but you know, I wouldn't go that far. And yet they've done it.
Yeah, and I think that's a great message and a great thing which people have found from this. So, Lucy, thank you. Lucy Quist, international business leader and author of the book, The Bold New Normal. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for your time on The A Perspective.
Thank you very much.